Iran cracks down on dissent ahead of the first anniversary of the death in police custody of a Kurdish woman arrested for alleged immodest dress, a death that triggered months of anti-government protests. Human Rights Watch tells us whom Iran is targeting now.
We have seen increased pressure on families of those who've been killed during the protest and those who are seeking justice and truth.
Plus, the son of a U.S. resident jailed in Iran since 2016 and left out of a U.S.-Iran prisoner deal tells us what he told a U.S. official in a recent phone call.
I told him, you have left my father behind. I told him the American government has given up and has given in to the Iranians' demands.
And we ask TankerTrackers.com what is behind Iran's surge in oil exports this month. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Rights activists say Iran is intensifying repression of internal dissent just weeks before the first anniversary of the death of Mahsa Amini. The 22-year-old ethnic Kurdish woman was detained on the streets of Tehran last September by Iran's morality police for allegedly not wearing her hijab or headscarf strictly enough in accordance with Iran's Islamist dress code for women. Witnesses said she was beaten during her arrest. She died in custody days later, triggering months of nationwide protests that marked the biggest challenge so far to Iran's 44-year rule by radical Islamist clerics. Tara Saperi-Farr is a senior Iran researcher at U.S. group Human Rights Watch. I spoke to her by phone on Tuesday and asked what kinds of repressive activity she has been observing in Iran.
To us, it appears that authorities are going on all-out assault against peaceful dissent and free speech ahead of the anniversary of the death in custody of Mahsa Jina Amini that sparked the nationwide protest last year. We have seen in recent weeks and months increased pressure on families of those who've been killed during the protest and those who are seeking justice and truth. They have been not only pressured not to hold memorials, but they have been summoned by authorities. Some of them have been arrested, the most outspoken ones. We have seen arrests of activists and peaceful dissidents, including popular singers, women's rights defenders, and also other citizens who've been critical of the government. Many of those who were released as part of the amnesty that was granted in February or on bail have also been called, sent notices to make sure to stay quiet ahead of the anniversary.
One aspect of the crackdown that I thought was particularly interesting is that many relatives and family members of people killed in the crackdown that happened at the end of last year. These are not people who are known activists themselves, but these are parents, siblings. They are coming under a lot of pressure right now. Why do you think the Iranian authorities are putting so much pressure on those people?
That's sadly the story of how Iranian authorities have been going about maintaining their full control over attempts for accountability and justice and basically impunity, ongoing impunity. You see families of those who've been killed unjustly in various crackdowns at the hands of authorities have become more and more vocal over the years. Some of them have found each other, tried to connect between different waves of these crackdowns. And I think, as you mentioned, they're not necessarily activists. They haven't arrived at this with a sense of mission, but they have been put in a place that this unjust tragedy has happened to them and they're speaking up and demanding their rights. And I think they have a very powerful message. It's very hard to push back. Like when a mother who has lost their loved one was being killed by authorities is asking for justice, is extremely difficult to push back on that.
Why is it so hard for them to push back on that?
They have created this narrative around the enemy that is leading all these protests and really bizarre narratives about how these people have lost their lives during the protest. And then you have a mother, a brother, a sister, a father who is asking for transparency and answers and investigations. And I think that helped gather a lot of sympathy in the society. And historically and traditionally, memorial services have been a place of gathering and call for justice in the Iranian recent history, even during the revolution. It has religious connotation. It has some sort of recent memory. So it's very difficult for them to push back on these. So they try to silence their call. It's very hard to say that a mother has been paid by foreign agents because there's a real story and a suffering that gets amplified. What has been interesting for me to see that many of these families have taken to social media themselves to tell their own story. So they're not leaving at the hand of anyone. They want to be the narrator of their story. And I think that's a powerful message. And authorities are realizing that they carry some legitimacy that's pretty broad and has a lot of sympathy among society. And I think that's why we're seeing stronger pushback on them. Otherwise, sadly, this has been a trend. Pressuring families into silence goes back to early days of the revolution, that the mass execution of political prisoners in the 80s, they've always been under pressure. But I think they are becoming more vocal. They're taking over their own narrative. They have more agency, and now they're facing more direct reprisals for their activism.
We are a couple of weeks away from the first anniversary of Mahsa Amini's death in police custody. How do you think this crackdown, this all-out assault that you talked about, is going to affect what happens in the next few weeks?
I mean, it's hard to tell. Usually in situations like this, we have seen deployment of force, very strict pressure on activists. So I think understanding how the society feels about this anniversary should not necessarily be measured by, for instance, how many street protests are observed. In a situation that a pop singer can be arrested for releasing a song that talks about women's resistance, it is hard to imagine that there's any space for people to peacefully gather to raise their voice. So I am not sure what we are heading for in terms of the exact date. What is clear is that not only the root causes that led to the widespread protests have not been addressed in any way, the repression has gotten worse in many different ways. So what we expect to see is continued crackdown on various forms of peaceful dissent going throughout the fall. I don't think the anniversary just as a date is going to magically disappear the popular discontent and frustration that have been brewing, and authorities' actions are just adding insult to injury at this point.
Tara Saperi-Farr, senior Iran researcher at Human Rights Watch, joining us on the phone from here in Washington, D.C. Great to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
Family members of two U.S. residents who have been jailed for years in Iran ended a more than week-long protest outside the State Department in Washington last Friday. They used the sit-in to raise awareness about their loved ones who have been left out of a U.S.-Iran prisoner deal. Under that agreement, Iran will allow five jailed American citizens to come home in return for the U.S. unfreezing billions of dollars of Iranian funds. The deal does not address the fate of the U.S. residents still jailed in Iran, Jamshid Sharmad and Shahab Dalili. The State Department said last week it has not determined whether Dalili is wrongfully detained. Such a designation would require the U.S. to work for his release under U.S. law. Dalili's son Darian, an American citizen, told me by phone that he discussed his father's case with U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Abram Paley, in a phone call on August 11th. I asked Darian how the call went.
I was very upset. I was very emotional during that phone call. I told him, you have left my father behind. I told him the American government has given up and has given in to the Iranians' demands, because his point of argument was that, you know, Iran is not willing to even discuss your father. And I was like, well, it sounds to me like you are giving in to whatever Iran says. overall, like I said, there wasn't any outcome out of the phone call. Just the fact that I made my feelings known, and he also said a bunch of things that, again, none of them were new. They were sort of stuff that Department of State always says. We are looking at every case individually, stuff like that.
But you mentioned that he told you something about Iran not being willing to discuss your father's case. That sounds relatively new to me. I mean, what exactly did he tell you?
He said that, yeah, like they are not even willing to have him be part of the conversation. And to this day, I do not 100% believe that.
And why not?
So when we talk about the Iran deal, now Americans are unhappy saying Iran is getting a lot of money. And I do see that part of it. But I like to look at things from both sides. So looking at it from the Iranian regime side, they are being humiliated by this deal. It's like, we have sold a bunch of oil to South Korea. We gave them the oil. The money never came to us. And now you're saying, okay, the money of the oil you sold, I'm going to put it on top of this closet. You can't reach it. Only I can reach it. You have to tell me what you want to buy with it. If I like it, if I like what you tell me, I'll go buy that thing and give it to you. That's the deal. For the oil that Iran has already sold to South Korea, it is very humiliating. So to me, the fact that they have accepted such a deal is a sign of desperation. And if they are desperate, they would not say no to the opportunity of getting even more money for one additional prisoner.
Is that what you think the Iranian government wants? More money for your father specifically?
Just in general, if they think by including more people, they could possibly get America to give them more, they will not say no to that.
Well, one thing that was interesting when I was reading the transcripts of the recent State Department press briefings that mentioned your father's case is that the spokesperson talked about how indicators are needed that someone is wrongfully detained in order for us to make a wrongful detention designation for anyone, like for your father, for example, and they haven't done that in your father's case. What kind of indicators is the State Department looking for, and have you and your family provided any such indicators to them?
I thank you for that question. If you found the answer, please let me know as well. I have been writing letters for years to the State Department, this administration, the previous administration, asking them, hey, what do you need? What is the roadblock? What is stopping you from making this designation? I have heard back nothing.
Well, what kind of indicators do you think they're looking for?
Okay, you want my honest opinion? My honest opinion is that there are no key indications, because as far as the charges, as far as the sentencing, my father is identical to several others who are being released. Same charge, same sentence, same number of years, everything.
Can you fill in our listeners on those charges and those aspects of your father's case?
Yep. The charge for my father, as well as all these other guys who are being released and famous prisoners who have been released already, you know, people like Mr. Nizar Zaka or Mr. Zhu Wang, all of them, including my dad, the charge that Iranians always bring against all of them is aiding and abetting a hostile nation. That's it.
So if your father has basically faced the same kinds of charges that these other Americans who have already been released and who are apparently going to be released also face, does that mean that there could be something else that the State Department needs to deem your father wrongfully detained? Or could it even mean that the State Department somehow thinks that your father wasn't wrongfully detained?
So if my father wasn't wrongfully detained, then that means he is guilty of this one and only charge that is being levied against him. What is that charge? Aiding and abetting the U.S. So if he is guilty of that, then he is your asset. Go get back your asset. So that's why they are sitting on their hands and they're not making a designation one way or the other. Because they know whichever way they make the designation, the result is they have to go get him back. Now, saying that, I personally 100% believe that my father is innocent of the charges levied against him, because he's not political, because he's never been political. He doesn't have the characteristics that you would need to be, you know, a spy or do any sort of espionage. So he doesn't have it in him. But, you know, you want to say he has done it? Okay, go get back your asset.
So going forward here, the sit-in that happened outside the State Department. That is now over. You were there for a week, and the members of the Sharmad family, whose relative Jamshid Sharmad is also a U.S. resident detained in Iran, who they want to get freed, they were also there. And you did get some publicity. You got some news coverage. What can you tell us about how that protest helped your cause, and what are your next steps?
I think it helped our cause in the sense that people who actually follow the news now know. Maybe they don't remember my dad's name. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But they at least know that, hey, you know, you remember back on August 10th when they were saying we're bringing everybody back home? It's not really everybody. Now people know that. Now people know that that message of, oh, we are bringing everyone back home, has a caveat to it. It's not 100% true. And I think that was a big win.
So what's next for you?
I am trying to get some congressional support. Now, I know a lot of reporters. Now, a lot of reporters have written about this story, have interviewed me about this story. I have contacts that I can keep pushing. I'm going to use that contact because what I've learned is that you need to keep pushing. So I'm going to keep pushing. I'm not giving up. And I'm going to make sure that everyone in this country knows that these people are leaving U.S. nationals, Americans behind.
Darian Dalili, son of Shahab Dalili, on the line from Springfield, Massachusetts. Thank you for being with us on Flashpoint Iran, and please keep us posted on your campaign.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. A company that monitors satellite imagery of oil tankers says it has seen a jump in Iran's oil exports in recent weeks, despite years of unilateral U.S. sanctions against international purchases of Iranian energy products. TankerTrackers.com estimates that Iran exported 2.2 million barrels of crude and condensate a day in the first 20 days of this month, putting August on track to be Iran's strongest for oil exports this year. The company uses satellites to keep track of hundreds of oil tankers suspected of violating U.S. sanctions, and then verifies their location using data emitted by the vessels via their Automatic Identification System, or AIS, transponders. I spoke to TankerTrackers.com co-founder Sam Madani on August 25th and asked how he and his colleagues have been able to monitor so many tankers on a daily basis.
When we used to track Iran back in 2018, once these sanctions were announced, it took like a full day just to visually confirm one tanker. And because we didn't have a process in place and it was all quite new to us and so on. And once you spend hundreds of and even thousands of hours doing this, you come up with not just a very good process, but you devise your own tools for this. So we built our own database and our own search engine for something like this. So when we do look at a satellite photo and we see that there is nothing on AIS to correspond with the photo, you know, then we run a search query on that and we're able to pull up candidates. And then we look at the candidates and we poll each candidate to see if they are so-called spoofing over AIS, meaning that they're misrepresenting their location. So they can say, for instance, that they're in country A when they're in fact in country B. And that happens with the case of Iran. There's a lot of tankers that will show that they're coming out of Oman or Iraq or the UAE, but they're in fact loading oil in Iran. And then once they arrive in China, the Chinese authorities will then receive paperwork showing that it came from Oman, Iraq, or UAE, and never Iran.
It's interesting that you mentioned paperwork because, you know, with your satellite imagery, you can obviously get a bird's eye view of the tankers. But how are you able to track something so tiny like paperwork?
So the paperwork, actually, I mean, when I say paperwork, there's a lot of data already available to the market, and that is the Chinese statistics that are published once a month on imports. And they'll show something which, you know, boggles everyone's mind, and that is the fact that they're importing a lot of oil from Malaysia. And they're importing so much oil that it actually is more than what Malaysia even produces, let alone exports. it's about twice as much, and if not more. And meanwhile, they're showing that they're importing next to nothing from Iran and Venezuela.
Officially.
Officially, exactly. So what happens is Malaysia is a midway point between Iran and China. And so the vessels come to Malaysia or in the EEZ waters off the coast of Malaysia towards the South China Sea. We call it the Riau Archipelago. And then they conduct ship-to-ship transfer operations of their oil cargo. You'll see 2 million barrels of oil come from Iran or Venezuela, and then an empty counterparty vessel would rest in parallel with it, and then they'll transfer the oil via hoses while their AIS transponders are spoofing, not just switched off, but they're spoofing, so they're misleading you in terms of their location. Because they want to show their insurers that they were online the entire time. They never switched off their transponders. And then they receive that oil, and then it goes up to China. And then in China, they get paperwork displayed in front of them. It says that the oil came from Malaysia. And it'll say that it's a Malay blend. You know, blend meaning that you can take in multiple oil sources and mix it up together. But that's just something to fill the blank with. But the oil, when they do the test, of course, will show that it came from a well in Iran or in Venezuela.
Now, you noted that Iran's exports have jumped in August compared to the previous months this year. What is behind this increase, do you think?
Yeah, my thinking behind this increase is not so much tied to like Iran boosting its oil production, although it could go up a little every month, but not a big boost the way we saw now with exports. Instead, what I think is going on is that they are draining their storage on shore. So that you got these storage tanks we keep the oil in. And they are sending that out because of the fact that Saudi Arabia and Russia have cut their exports as part of their agreement within OPEC, OPEC Plus. And so China needs the oil, or China wants to buy cheap oil right now in particular, because they had a pretty good deal with Russia until Russia started slashing exports. And then the Iranians quickly stepped up and they sent out, you know, 2 million barrels per day of crude oil and 200,000 barrels of gas condensate a day. So now it's like it kind of peaked maybe around 20 days into August. And now it's almost like I would say it's plateauing. It's too soon to say it's plateauing, but it's probably not going to hold much longer than August in any case. Because if you're draining storage to do this, it's not going to last too long. But I could well see it probably going on for another week or two.
What is your expectation for how Iranian oil exports are going to ebb and flow in the coming weeks and months? Are you expecting to go back to the levels we saw earlier this year?
I think for this year, the average is something like 1.2 million barrels of crude and another 150 to 200,000 barrels of condensate. And I don't think the average will raise too much beyond that, to be honest with you.
And why is that?
I think what they had now was just a fire sale, you know, the big volume push because there was a demand and they were able to sell at a better discount than the Russians. And that's also the going thinking I read, that they're offering something like $10 less per barrel. So, I mean, it's a good discount.
It does seem that way. Sam Madani, co-founder of TankerTrackers.com, speaking to us from Sweden. Thank you so much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you for having me.
That brings us to the end of this week's program. You can subscribe to more episodes on Apple and Google Podcasts. If you're using the Apple app, feel free to leave a review. Also, let me know what Iran-related topics you're interested in hearing about in future podcasts. Post me a message on the X social media platform using my account name, @Michael_Lippin. We have more VOA coverage of Iran 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com. On behalf of the Flashpoint Iran team, thank you for listening, and we invite you to join us again next week.